This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Steve Gilbert, director and founder of the Institute of Neurotoxicology and Neurological Disorders, a nonprofit institute dedicated to research and education in the neurosciences. Steve also serves as affiliate associate professor in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences at the University of Washington, authored the book A Small Dose of Toxicology, and is an advisor for the Lead Chemical Action Plan, which is part of the Department of Ecology's program to phase out persistent toxic chemicals in Washington State. Steve Gilbert is here today to tell us about the health hazards of lead and to recommend steps we can take as a society and as individuals to reduce or eliminate lead exposure. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you, Diane.
Would you begin by giving us an overview of the hazards of lead for human health?
Well, lead has a long history. We knew 2,000 years ago that lead makes the mind give way. And what we've learned in the last 30 years, really, is that there are a lot of more subtle effects associated with lead exposure, particularly for children. Children are exquisitely sensitive to the health effects of lead. It mars their intelligence, really robs them of their potential, takes away from their ability to learn, think, and remember, ultimately reducing their IQ. So it has some very subtle effects that we really need to pay attention to, and very low levels of exposure are detrimental to a child's developing nervous system. The newest information has come out associating lead with asthma, that increased levels of asthma, also with lead.
What are the properties of lead that make it a problem?
Well, the most important one is it's persistent. Lead substitutes for calcium, so if you take in a little bit of lead, it substitutes for calcium, ends up in your bones, moves into your nervous system. So the problem is we've got a lot of lead in the environment. It's an interesting compound used in many products, and it persists in our bodies and in the environment.
How long does lead remain in the human body following exposure?
Well, it remains in the blood for about 30 days. It's called the half-life, so how long it lasts in the blood. It drops by half in about 30 days. But the problem is that when it moves into the bone, it stays for a much longer period of time. So if there's events that start decalcifying the bone, then you release that lead back into the body. For example, a woman that was exposed early on to lead when she was growing up has lead in her bone, and during pregnancy, that lead will be mobilized because during the child needs calcium, the bone demineralizes, and that lead's remobilized into the blood.
Would you comment on the studies that have correlated lead exposure with crime?
Yeah, there have been a number of studies that have correlated lead exposure with crime and other sort of juvenile delinquencies. And part of that's because children don't do well in school. They don't learn or remember well, so then they seek other activities, and they end up going more antisocial behavior. So there's good correlation between elevated blood lead levels and crime in general, and juvenile delinquency.
And how solid is this information?
I think it's very solid. There have been a number of studies. This study has been replicated a number of times. So we've got from several different cities. So it's very solid information.
Are there effective treatments for lead poisoning?
There's really no effective treatments for lead poisoning. Once you get lead poisoning, you really have lead poisoning, and you can't reverse the effects of that. So if you have a small decrement in your IQ, that lasts a lifetime. It really robs you of your quality of life.
How widespread are the health effects of lead in the United States?
Well, lead was removed from gasoline, which is a really important public health move. Probably one of the greatest mistakes made as far as public health goes was putting lead in gasoline. But once it was removed, blood leads did drop significantly. Right now, the problem is lead in homes. Lead was left in paint. In Europe, lead was banned. Europe banned lead-based paint in the 1920s. The United States persisted in using lead-based paint until the mid-70s. And many of the homes still have lead-based paint. So children are exposed to lead in the dust and dirt around homes. Now we see a number of products coming out with lead-based paint in them.
How widespread are the effects of lead in Washington State? Is it the same as for the U.S. as a whole, or are there any special issues here?
Well, Washington State's fairly fortunate. It has a good housing stock, is well-maintained. But there's still places where lead exposure is prevalent, so we still need to be watchful. For example, lead arsenate pesticides were used in eastern Washington for quite a while, which put a lot of lead in the dirt around homes and around schools. The Tacoma Smelter in our area, they used a lot of smelting for lead and copper and arsenic, and that lead and arsenate blew up into our King County area.
Could you tell us how we test for lead?
Well, the most common test for lead is blood, so you want to use your blood lead levels, and that gives you an indication of most recent lead exposure. There are other tests where you can use some x-ray equipment that tests for lead stored in the bone. So the blood lead test gives you an indication of most recent lead exposure.
You've alluded to this already, but how have the levels of lead found in blood changed over time?
We're fortunate over time, lead levels on the average have dropped. This doesn't mean, though, that some individuals aren't exposed to lead. For example, if a worker is or a family member is working with lead in the workplace, they can take home lead into the home environment. Lead gets into the dust around the home. And because children are acceptable to lead, a child will absorb 50% of the lead that they ingest, whereas an adult only absorbs about 10%. So that's one of the reasons children are more susceptible. So if a worker brings lead home, they have that increased exposure. And then kids that are exposed to lead in toys, other products, there's lead in candy now, in other small jewelries, this is increases lead exposure.
So lead is found naturally in the environment. Is there any sense of how much lead we have in our blood now compared to before, say, industrialization?
Well, it's an interesting question. If you look at history, you can see as we've industrialized and industry has gone up and down, that lead exposure has increased. Like during the Roman Empire, when there was a lot of industry, there was a lot more lead exposure. Then as we went through the Dark Ages, we didn't mine and do a lot of lead mining, and lead wasn't used as much in plumbing and other products. Lead exposure dropped off. And now you see lead exposure dropping, blood lead levels dropping because they're removing from lead from gasoline and gradually getting it out of the paint in the home. So there's been a cycle of lead exposure. This has been tracked in Arctic and other areas around the world.
What are the implications of lead exposure for our society as a whole if you look at all the effects?
I think on the whole, you see that it's affected, you know, different classes of people differently. Like, for example, I grew up in the 50s. I've exposed to lead and gasoline. You know, maybe if I had a few more IQ points, I might have been a full professor. You just never know about these things. But I think on the whole, it's damaged a lot of kids. It's increased crime in some areas of the city. There was just a recent study in New York City showing that the drop in lead levels correlated with a drop in crime. So that was lagged by about 20 years as these kids with lower lead levels came through the system. So I think it has a huge impact on society. There's been a couple studies done trying to look at the cost from neurodevelopment point of view, that the lowered IQ has a decreased amount of money that you can make as you develop. So that also is, you know, has very serious implications for society as a whole, as well as for the individual that's not able to do as well as they could, and really robs them of their potential.
How do the risks of lead compare with other environmental toxins to which we are exposed?
I think lead's one of the more serious environmental toxicants they're exposed to, along with some of the other heavy metals like mercury. So I think that lead is, because it's persistent, it's widely used in compounds, it's still associated with lead-based paint, and has been in the news lately, a number of childhood products been recalled, that lead continues to show up in our society, and we really do need to pay attention to it. Because the more we studied lead, the more we realize the subtle damage it does to the nervous system. And that has profound effects on the individual and for society as a whole. And I think, ultimately, we have a duty and responsibility in our society to help take care of our children. And one of the ways we take care of our children is to ensure that they're not exposed to lead.
Which sources of lead exposure are of most concern? You've already mentioned a few of them. Maybe you could go through those again and kind of highlight the ones that we should be most worried about.
Well, I think the first one you want to be worried about is lead in paint. And I think that's for older homes. Any home that was built before 1978, you'd be thinking about lead in paint. Any home in the 50s or earlier almost surely has lead-based paint. So you really want to watch out for that because lead gets into the dust and kids get exposed to that dust in the homes. I think the next thing you want to do is watch out for consumer products that have lead in them and be wary of that from toys that are there, from jewelry that is made out of lead. Home hobbies can also be a source of lead. If somebody does a lot of fishing, manufactures lead waste, or does leaded glass in their home, they need to be thoughtful about the lead exposure that might occur. And lunch boxes have shown up with lead, polyvinyl chlorine. Lead is used to stabilize the plastics, make them flexible. So there's a number of consumer products, and I think we need to be really paying attention to that and do a better job of corralling those products and also paying attention to lead-based paint. So I think those are the big concerns now.
How does lead end up in the products? In some cases, of course, it's chosen because it has properties that make the product what you want it to be. And in other cases, I understand that it can be a contaminant. Could you just comment on that?
Well, it's a little bit of both, as you mentioned. Lead-based paint is an excellent paint. Lead is a great colorant. It helps paint dry, and it is very sturdy, strong paint. It's excellent paint, but there are good substitutes for that. In other products, it's added in there as a contaminant. Some products, it's added in increased weight. So a product that's sold by weight, you add a little bit of lead to it, you increase the weight. And others, there are contaminants in manufacture, and the equipment that was used is old. Lead can get in the water supply, too. Seattle school system had lead in the drinking water, and that was from pipes and old fittings that were used. So it's a number of places that lead sort of creeps into our society and into our system.
To what extent are the sources of lead contamination ones that are homegrown as opposed to being brought in from abroad? Recently, there have been the recall of toys.
Well, there's a little bit of both. You know, we've got the lead coming from abroad, and I think that's had a lot of news and things like that. But again, we've got our own homegrown issues with the Tacoma lead smelter that contaminated a lot of ground. We've got the Eastern Washington lead in the ground over there from the pesticide use. And then we've got our own home, our housing stock here in Washington State that's older that has lead in it. So there's a bit of both. We shipped a lot of the lead over to China, for example. And we had our consumer products, our telephones and our cell phones and our computers were sent out to developing countries where they're dismantled, that lead gets in reuse and is essentially circulated back to us. I think we need to be thoughtful about where lead is used. There's new laws. For example, Europe is requiring lead-free components in solder now. We've tried to eliminate lead from many of the products. Pipe solder for plumbing, we've removed lead from that. And the new laws in Europe and are coming to the United States are trying to remove lead from consumer-based products also.
I'm Diane Horn, and we're speaking with Steve Gilbert, director of the Institute of Neurotoxicology and Neurological Disorders. Our topic is the health hazards of lead and what we can do to reduce or eliminate lead exposure. To what extent is industrial pollution still a problem or still a source of lead? What kind of role does it play?
Well, it actually still plays a significant role, particularly in mining. Smelting is still an issue. There's some areas in the United States where smelters are still going that produce a lot of lead into the environment. Certainly in developing countries, this is a major issue. Some of the controls aren't placed on it like they have in the United States and other developed countries where they're still doing a lot of very crude smelting, and this lead gets into the environment again. So there are a number of industrial sources for it. And that's one thing Washington State will be looking at with their chemical action plan. They're going to try to look at how to control lead. Are there other sources of lead? There's lead shot used in hunting. There's lead in sinkers for fishing. So there's a variety of little sources of lead that keep showing up.
Who is most at risk for adverse health effects from lead? You've already alluded to this.
Well, I think the most important thing are children, because there are a number of reasons they're more susceptible. As I mentioned, they absorb more lead than adults do, that their nervous system is developing, so the lead moves to the nervous system and affects that. They also have a number of behaviors that make them more susceptible. Kids are more hand-to-mouth. They get into the dust and the dirt, and lead can get tracked into home, into the carpet. They have the hand-to-mouth behavior that encourages lead absorption. So they're more susceptible from those realms. So it's really children. They're small, so a small amount of lead means a big dose, so a small exposure to a big dose compared to an adult. And that developing nervous system is really sensitive to lead. And we got to remember, we're not exposed to just lead. We're exposed to a variety of contaminants. There's a little bit of mercury from our fish, a little bit of PCBs, a little bit of PBDEs. We go along the alphabet soup of different compounds, but and a little bit of stress. All these things add up to causing other problems, whether it's a hyperactivity disorder, maybe a little bit of autism. All these things that we're seeing in our society could be due to multiple exposures to small amounts of these compounds.
What can parents do to protect their children?
I think one of the most important things you can do for children is pay attention to your home. Keep it clean, vacuum the carpets regularly, and wash your children's hands. I think the biggest thing from all public health standpoints is wash your hands. When you come in from outside or you're playing, have the children wash their hands before they eat. It's really important. And make sure it does keep the house clean, as I mentioned, carpet. In Washington State here in Seattle, we have a Master Home Environmentalist Program that's sponsored by the American Lung Association. If you have any questions or would like a little home inspection, the Master Home Environmentalist can come out and help you improve your home environment. For example, putting a walk-off mat, taking your shoes off when you come into the home, greatly reduced amount of contaminants that get moved into your home, keep your home clean, and keep your kids safe from lead.
What can parents do about products that may contain lead and put their children at risk?
You know, the product one is an interesting one because we don't have good laws requiring indicating what's in our consumer products. We have a right to know what's on many of our products, and we just don't know. We have a lot of products. Cosmetics is an example where we don't know all the ingredients in these products. We don't know what's in these products as far as lead paint goes. There hasn't been good inspection of these products coming in. The consumer product safety at the federal level, their funding has been reduced considerably over the last dozen years or so. They're not doing the jobs they should be doing. I think we really need to, you know, reinvest in our society, reinvest in some of these important aspects of our government that help control the products and help protect public safety. We need to be really thoughtful of our children, and we need to invest. This is one of the investments we make in our children, and I guarantee you get a really big return on investment from protecting children from lead exposure.
What regulations are in place to help protect us from adverse health effects from lead exposure?
Well, there are requirements. For example, the Medicaid children, there are testing requirements. They're not well followed. So you try to do that. There's been laws about reducing lead from lead-based paints or removing lead from paint. Lead from gasoline was removed. There's increased looking at consumer products as far as lead solder goes, removed from that. So they have moved to try to move lead out of products. But what we're not doing is sort of making sure that really sticks, like you've seen these product recalls and this increased sensitivity about products coming in from outside United States manufacturers. Lead was found in candy coming from Mexico. It's still occasionally found in pottery. So lead just keeps creeping back into the system. So I think that you have to really be vigilant about lead despite the rules and regulations that we have in place regarding lead.
Could you focus on the efforts that have been made so far to address the problem of lead poisoning in the U.S.? To what extent have they been effective?
Well, overall, removing lead from gasoline has been very effective. But I think what we haven't done is sort of look at some of the other sources of lead. And in Washington State, we're trying to do that. We have a really interesting program, the Persistent Bioaccumulative Toxics Program, PBTs. And in that, we put a chemical action plans together. So we've done one on mercury and one on brominated flame retardants. We're now working on one on lead. And those plans go through and look at all the sources and potential exposure routes of lead. So we're going to look at different routes of exposure from lead-based paint to dirt to sinkers to home hobbies. You know, what areas can we do in Washington State to remove lead from the environment so that children aren't being exposed? And although the report doesn't have any regulatory authority, it often leads to regulation. For example, after the brominated flame retardants report came out, they moved to eliminate brominated flame retardants from many consumer products. So we will hope to see some regulatory efforts come out of the chemical action plan for lead that we're working on.
Are there other states that are planning similar efforts?
You know, I don't know of any other state that's working on something. I think we should be really proud of the work going on in Washington State and the Department of Ecology and Department of Health and what they're doing in that. And I think a lot of people will be looking at this chemical action plan on lead to sort of see what we do. I mean, a number of states have moved to try to reduce lead exposure to their children, but nothing as comprehensive that I'm aware of as the chemical action plan in Washington.
What types of efforts are currently being made at the federal level to protect us from lead exposure?
Well, at the federal level, the Center for Disease Control has a blood lead action level. So you measure your blood lead levels, and that's set at 10 micrograms per deciliter. And they have a committee that looks at that. And a few of us have been arguing that the Center for Disease Control should lower that blood lead action level from 10. We've argued that it should be down at 2. You know, it should be down below 10, because we've got great data showing that there are health effects from 2 to 10. And you actually have a greater IQ loss when your blood lead levels for children goes from 2 to 10 than if it goes from 10 to 20. So the IQ loss is greater at these lower level exposures. There was just a really recent paper that came out looking at blood leads below 10 micrograms per deciliter in elementary school children, again showing performance degradation below 10 micrograms per deciliter. So I think one of the most important things the federal level could happen is they sort of get on board with the new science that's out there and accept the level that we have good data showing that blood lead levels below 10 are detrimental to children's health, and give people that information that action should be taken. If a child's blood level is above 2, there's some exposure to lead, and we should be looking around the home, in our environment, in our school systems, in our daycare centers, and asking ourselves, where is that lead coming from? So we're being thoughtful and preventing that, because you really need to prevent lead exposure. You can't go back and treat lead exposure. Prevention is the most important thing you can do. You need to take a precautionary approach to lead exposure.
What fraction of children in the U.S. and also specifically in Washington State have various levels of lead? If you looked at, say, above the 10 microgram per deciliter amount and then, say, 2 to 10.
Right off, I don't have the data from above 10 micrograms per deciliter, but it's several hundred thousand children across the United States that have blood leads above 10. This is sort of people of poor economic backgrounds often have elevated lead levels in a poor neighborhood. So we've differentially exposed kids to lead. So people that are, you know, struggling with a poor environment and nutrition. I just want to mention quickly about nutrition, because if you aren't consuming enough calcium and iron in your diet, you absorb more lead. So people that have poor nutrition end up having increased lead levels. So that's a problem. We don't have a lot of data for below 10 micrograms per deciliter. We don't have good data like from 2 to 5. There's some data out there. So I think the most important thing to do would be to drop that blood lead action levels and do more testing of that. I think Washington State, for example, could do a lot more testing of their children that are in that 2 to 4 age range. And we'd then have that data to find out more about that.
To what extent are children in Washington State tested for lead?
Well, they're sort of sporadically tested, in which I think there is some groups have just written in looking to try to increase that, because the federal Medicare dollars require children to be tested for blood lead. Often it's not done in Washington State because the people say, well, Washington State's got a good housing stock. We really don't need to be testing kids. But that really doesn't go after the little pockets of areas where we could have potential problems, either older housing or maybe there's an area there was lead contamination, the soil. So we're not addressing the issue for, you know, individual kids. It might look great when you look at the average blood lead, but we are causing problems for some children. And if lead caused cancer instead of just a neurobehavioral problem, think of the difference we would be approaching lead. So lead, it affects children, their neurobehavioral effects. You can't really see it as an individual. It's really population-based studies that see that. And we really need to take lead exposure and contamination seriously and do better and more testing of our children.
You've been alluding to this, but what are your recommendations as to how best to proceed in reducing or eliminating lead exposure at the level of public policy?
I think the most important thing to do is, you know, education about sources of lead. But I think we need to have substitutes. For example, substitutes for fishing gear, you know, is one thing you could do. Substitutes for the wheel weights on your cars, removing lead from those because those wheel weights fall off, contaminate the environment. Lead shot. There's a variety of sorts of lead. And most importantly, we need to clean up the housing. We need to make a bigger effort to go in there and remove lead and abate lead from the older housing stock or remove that housing. So I think we need to make an investment in the future of our children and go after that old housing stock. The most important thing to do is the lead-based paint. We can also do better testing. There is a law in Washington State where there's testing for lead contamination that might have come from the Tacoma smelter. We could do better testing, for example, in eastern Washington and daycare centers and schools that might have been sited on old orchards that had a lot of lead arsenic used in pesticides. So we need to be finding out where that lead is, abating the lead, and really testing our children better, looking for those little pockets of potential contamination, and having better education. Have pediatricians hand out pamphlets about lead, how to take your shoes off, encouraging hand washing. There's a lot of little things we could do that would reduce exposure for children.
What kind of financial resources are available to deal with the issue of lead?
That's a big question. So the financial resources are always tight, but I think there's little things you could do. As I mentioned, you could hand out brochures to pediatricians. I know that all the doctors are very sensitive about the time, and it takes a lot of time, a little bit of time, I think, to talk about lead. But I think that's one important thing we could do. And I think we need to look at this as an investment in the future of our children, an investment in our society. And I think if you take it from that perspective, it's a small investment. You get big returns on the investment. And I think that goes for, you know, particularly for children. We got to make those investments in our children and accept it. It's going to cost a little bit of money. And I think those are really well-spent dollars in Washington State.
Let's focus now on the Department of Ecology Chemical Action Plan for lead, which you're advising and which is currently being developed as part of the Department of Ecology's program to phase out persistent toxic chemicals in Washington State. Why was lead chosen at this time to focus on?
Well, they've removed a number of chemicals. So there is a list of persistent bioaccumulative toxins that Washington State's going to eventually produce chemical action plans for. But lead was right up there because of its detrimental effects on neurobehavioral development of children and their ability to remember and learn. So lead was moved right up there. It's something we can do something about. We know where lead is. We can come up with good alternatives to lead in products. We can try to eliminate lead in products. For example, we could give Ecology and Department of Health more authority to recall products or eliminate products coming in Washington State that do contain lead. So there are a lot of things that could be done with lead exposure, and it's a major problem. And lead was widely used in Washington State, well, and really around the country, but it's a good one to look at because it has such a dramatic effect on kids, and there are things we can do about it.
Who's involved in developing the plan?
There's an advisory committee, which I'm on, and there are a number of people from industry people, representatives from the fishing industry, for example. There's a number of state agencies on it. Some environmental groups are there. So there's a wide range of people that the Department of Ecology, who manage the program, Department of Health, called together to talk about lead exposure and what we can do about it. We try to come up with sort of a consensus. They try to take the opinions in of business community, what the impact on the business community would be of removing lead, and we need to be listening and thinking about the impacts of lead exposure and removal an alternative to lead from their perspective. We need to look at the environmental community and ask what can be done there. We need to get lead out of the general environment. It's not good for wildlife either. I don't think we should definitely remember that. And that's something that the committee will be looking at also. So it's really a really interesting process. I think it's a great process to go through. But I think we also need to have a better overall. We can't spend the next 20 years going through this whole list of persistent bioaccumulative toxicants. There's going to be a new compounds coming out there. And we need to have a better chemical action plan. So we need to have an overall policy and what's called a chemical policy approach to managing chemicals in our environment, and have a approach where we're looking at the safety and health effects of these chemicals before they get out into the environment, before we're exposed to them, so we know what we shouldn't be using in our products.
What is the timeline for completion of the lead chemical action plan, and when will public comment take place?
I believe public comment will be toward the end of the year. They're going to move try to fairly quickly on this plan. So I think they hope to have it out around the first part of the year. So I look for public comment in the fall.
And so what will be the nature of the recommendations?
Well, I think it's a little too early to say exactly what they'll be, but I think they'll see a number of recommendations. I'm hoping to see a recommendation that the blood lead action level be reduced, you know, at least to 5 and perhaps below that. I think there'll be some recommendations on substitution for different products and perhaps recommendations to give Department of Ecology and Health and other agencies more authority to recall products or ban products in Washington State stores. So I think there'll be things like that, and I think they'll look at seriously at the manufacturing processes, ways to move lead out of the manufacturing processes for electronic circuit boards and things like that. So I think there'll be, you know, a wide range of recommendations. I think it'll be a real interesting report because lead affects so many segments of our society, from the business community to manufacturing to, you know, the dirt in our homes to lead-based paint to jewelry to candy. Can we stop the importation of these candy in our stores and ban those products that have lead? And so it has some real interesting implications for how we manage consumer products in Washington State. So this is going to be a sort of a test in a way of how we're going to do this in the future. So I think the Lead Chemical Action Plan will be very interesting. I really encourage people to take a look at this and actually get involved in a committee. It's an open process. Anybody can come to these committee meetings. It's on the Department of Ecology's website. So I really encourage people to make comments, look at the material. They're posting all the materials, all their presentation material is posted on the website.
Would you like to say just a few words about Toxopedia.org and the Healthy World Theater projects that you're also involved with?
Oh, thank you very much for asking about that. Toxopedia is a product, and I'm sure many of your listeners have played a little bit with Wikipedia. So Toxopedia, we're trying to develop a wiki-based site, but it's going to be a reviewed site so people can trust the information on the site to have a range of chemicals. And what our real goal is to try to really demonstrate how toxicology is woven in throughout society. We have a large history section on the site to really show, like, example, you look at lead. Lead's got a fascinating history, interaction with, you know, European work and what Roman Empire and when it was discovered. So we can look in the sociology of that. And then Healthy World Theater was sort of came out of Toxopedia, where I give a lot of talks about lead and other chemicals, and I get tired of just talking about the facts. I really wanted to reach out to the emotions and hearts of people and have a different way of doing that. So we're looking for plays and poems and poetry, skits, even jokes. Like, we need to know how many toxicologists does it take to change a light bulb. You know, we need to know these things. So I want to try to put together a different set of resources. Ultimately, we're going to have a Healthy World Theater Lyceum on September 29th. So we're going to try to get people together to talk about health issues and environment and, you know, plays, poems, poetry, skits, comics. There's some very interesting comics out there that deal with mercury and dioxin from a local person that does comics in our area here. So I think there's a lot of resources out there, and we need to be reaching out to people in different ways and really talking about these problems from many different perspectives.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think the most important message is be mindful of what you're exposing to and really protect the potential of your children and take a precautionary approach to chemical exposures. We need to prevent exposures and even be thoughtful about the little exposure we get, because a little exposure from a variety of chemicals adds up, you know, whether it's a little bit of mercury, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. So I think that's the big message, is be thoughtful, try to educate yourself about these products. And, you know, there's a lot of resources out there, and to look around for those things.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Steve.
Yeah, thank you very much. I really appreciate this opportunity.
We have just been speaking with Steve Gilbert, Director of the Institute of Neurotoxicology and Neurological Disorders. For more information, check on the web at www.asmalldoseof.org and also www.toxopedia.org. Again, that's asmalldoseof.org and toxopedia.org. You can also call Steve at area code 206-527-0926. Again, that's 206-527-0926. The Sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters Sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week.